Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I'm Doug Cunnington, and today I'm going to talk to Monica Levy. How's it going today, Monica?
Great to be here.
Monica is a former lawyer that retired early at age 40. She went back to work in the tech and startup industry, and she's had several inflection points along the way, including immigrating to the US at age 17, starting to invest early in her career, taking steps to end a lucrative career in law, and a battle with cancer. There's really so much to cover today, and I'm going to do my best to like fit it all in. Currently, Monica spends her time traveling and works some as a self-disciplined coach. We'll talk about her journey to retirement, what she's been doing after retiring as a lawyer. She has a boyfriend that is still working in a corporate job. So we'll talk about what it's like to have a partner or spouse or otherwise that's still working when you're not. And through some of the pre-interview discussion that we've had, I know that travel is like one of your number one passions. So I'm curious, let's start there. Something fun, something that you're looking forward to. Do you have any like trips coming up, or maybe a recent trip in the last year where you're like, I really am just pumped about this?
Oh my God, that's my favorite topic ever. I'm leaving for Spain 2 days from now, but that's not super exciting because I live there. This is mostly for my boyfriend who's never been there. And I think it's a little bit challenging. The selfish part of me wants to always go to new places. I've been to 108 countries and he's been to 5. So trying to find a good balance is not always easy, but I do a lot of solo travel. And last year I went to South Africa for 2 weeks and it was just so incredibly beautiful in every way, culturally and nature-wise and food and wine-wise. And it just, I didn't know what to expect. And I was incredibly pleased, had a blast. So that's one of my latest adventures.
How many languages do you speak?
I speak 5.
What are they?
It sounds like a lot, but when you grow up in a small country, especially in Europe, 2 are almost granite. So I'm Bulgarian, so I speak Bulgarian. I speak Russian because I grew up during communism, so that was a given. And then I speak Italian, Spanish, and English. And I lived in Argentina, Spain, and Italy. So those were, again, by default. So I don't take a lot of credit, but it's helpful to have a few under my belt.
Do you, and I take it you're pretty much fluent in all of them, is that?
So I'm fluent in, well, Bulgarian for sure, and Spanish, but Italian, because they're so close and neither one of them is native, my brain I don't feel like I can be fluent in both. So if I were in Italy, Italian would pick up, but for the most part, Spanish is stronger at all times.
Gotcha. And then do you dream, what language do you dream in, or which languages do you dream in?
Yeah, I don't know. I would suspect English. I don't remember my dreams, but I think if I'm living in a country that's the prevalent language, I think in and dream in.
Okay. Interesting. That's a whole other topic, but really cool. I mean, I know Europeans are different in that they often learn many languages for so many different reasons. My mom's Filipino, she's passed away now, but like, I wish that was one thing. Like, it would be awesome to have had those synapses made when I was young, and maybe it'd be easier to learn more languages if your brain is sort of used to it from a young age. So, well, let's go back. So you're from Bulgaria originally. You made it to the US at age 17. Tell us the story.
So during communism, if you could leave, that was the goal. And I got accepted to college in the US. And I was 17 only because I started school at 5. And the college in Ohio, I didn't have a great college experience. I was very new to the US culture and kind of didn't really fit in. But then went to law school at Northwestern in Chicago and I loved that. I went to law school mostly because I needed a student visa to stay in the country. And so I knew I'd get a graduate degree, which I did. Took a job at the big law firm and kind of that followed that trajectory, got my MBA later. That's all there is to that. But it was certainly an interesting transition way back in the day before email. I was 17, continent apart from my family. It was not the easiest way to communicate. And so I remember I would record tapes and then send them back home. And 30 days later, my mother would know what was happening with me a month earlier. And so that was the way to stay in touch. But yeah, I mean, it was a good experience. I certainly loved the opportunity and made the most of it.
And I was going to ask you about law, and you said, I knew grad school would take longer and you wanted to stay longer. Can you expand on that? Like what other things? Because you obviously were able to get into a very good law school and had a lucrative career. So I assume you had some skills and areas that made you think, oh, law is actually something that I want to, you know, study more and maybe get into.
I wish it was more thought out like that, but my mother was a lawyer. My grandpa was a doctor. My dad was an engineer. So it was going to be either law school, med school, or MBA. And I hate it. I couldn't look at law. So it was not going to be med school. And I felt closer to my mom than my dad. So I felt law school is the choice. It literally was as simple as that. And I wish I could say I was always dreamt of being a lawyer.
Interesting. Well, and that makes sense. I mean, I picked my major because it was one of the higher paying engineering degrees that you can get. And I went to an engineering school. So yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people, and you had like some family legacy to drive you in that direction too. So, okay. Very good. Moving on, obviously, like you said, if you were able to get out of, you know, a communist country, that was preferable. Are there any specific things from your upbringing and your, you know, growing up in Bulgaria and your family that specifically, especially looking back, like informed your financial decisions or retiring early or anything like that? And if there's nothing, that's okay, but just curious how that shapes everything.
Yeah, that's a good question. I believe that we do have a lot of childhood opportunities that shape who we are. I didn't have any financial education. Everything in Bulgaria was bought in cash and the government subsidized a lot of our life. So I didn't know anything about savings or, sorry, credit card or investments, but I did know how to save. We're all by default frugal just because of the way we had to live. So coming to the US, I had frugality going for me, but I knew nothing about investments. So I believe that what helps you retire early is good savings rate, time, and investments. And I had the savings part. I didn't at the time know anything about investments or, you know, compound interest or any of that. Later on in my 20s, I met a mentor who told me that I should invest, and she introduced me to a Morgan Stanley broker. And that really helped me start the journey to FI without me realizing I was doing that. So I started investing in my late 20s. I'd already saved a good chunk of time. And so I had time on my side, investments and savings. But I do reflect on how lucky I was, because despite having two graduate degrees, I had zero understanding of financial literacy and what one needs to do. And I think that's probably still the case. And I feel just very fortunate that I met someone who thought to tell me, hey, you should start investing. So back to your question, frugality was probably the only thing that influenced my journey. Definitely not wanting to retire early. I still followed a very linear path of get a good job and work for the rest of your life. So thankfully, in my early 30s, I came across some folks that opened up my eyes to the possibility of a completely different lifestyle.
Gotcha. And so you started investing in your late 20s. So if I'm doing the math right, you were practicing as a lawyer for a few years beforehand. And in our 20s, we're just like getting our feet under us and that sort of thing. So were you literally just like putting the money in the checking account and you were saving and you're like, hey, this is great. I'm earning like a great salary, probably in an expensive city, right?
Yeah, I was living in Chicago. I was earning way more than I could spend. I think starting salary was $120,000. I was 24. So I remember having about $100,000 by the time I was 29. I had bought and sold a home at a loss at the time because we had to move out of Chicago to New York when the market was down. Nonetheless, I had $100,000 in savings. And when I met this older lady who introduced me to investing, I was well below the threshold for Morgan Stanley investments, but she asked them for an exception. And that's how I got started.
How did you find this mentor? Like, she was just in your life, a family friend or something, or what?
I moved to New York City for my ex-husband's job, who was a professor at Columbia. So we were in Columbia housing with much older folks. And I was doing some fitness training on the side, and she was one of my clients, took liking to me. And I was going through a divorce at the time, and she said, you know, you should consider investing. And I was like, what? That's how I met her. And to this day, I'm super grateful.
Gotcha. Okay. And you mentioned Morgan Stanley, which I assume they probably charge like assets under management or some other more complex fee structure, which I just want to point out this example because you still retired early. And while it wasn't optimal, it was like still moving in the right direction. So can you talk about that? I mean, you were just like, oh, investing, you were, I mean, you're smart. You probably knew about compound interest, but you didn't maybe know it applied to you and how an individual can make this work. Can you talk about the, you know, the fee structure and then maybe just like the impact of actually starting in your late 20s versus, you know, not realizing it until later?
So it was definitely an AUM or assets under management, 1% fee traditional. I do believe that they were wonderful, very talented folks who did a good job for me. I didn't know at the time there was any other fee arrangement. They were fiduciaries. They were honest, and I was very diligent about asking questions about fees, about their commission. So I was very clear on what I was paying. I thought that was the only way to have a financial advisor, but I was very happy with what they were doing for me. And I think at the time, obviously my network or my investment portfolio was small enough that the fee wasn't super impactful. And then having time on my side was what mattered. And then saving, I kept getting promoted often and had huge bonuses, and that just went into my investment portfolio. So that really helped. I had no desire to learn about investing and do it on my own. Like, there are certain things that I just want to delegate out to an expert. There are other things that I want to do myself, but investing has never been one of them, mostly because of the emotional aspect. I feel that I do want someone to hold my hand when there's volatility, and I find that to be enough of a value that I get out of working with someone who's an expert. So it was never with the intent of retiring early. It was just the right thing to do at the time. And that's how I started.
Since we're on the topic of advisors, Elizabeth and I, my wife, used an advisor. I want to give a shout out to Travis and Eddie over at Downshift, because Monica, you and I met because Eddie was like, hey, we have a client in town. So you work with Travis and Eddie, and, you know, kind of springboarding off of what you just mentioned, like, you are smart, but you don't have an interest in getting in the weeds. And one of the reasons why it can be valuable, it's not for everyone, but why it can be valuable, is it's great to have a second set of eyes, or a few people, if it's a, you know, a company with a few advisors there to just have a look. So can you talk about, and we'll go back to the story, but can you talk a little bit about working with an advisor? Like, what was it like? Did it give you peace of mind? Obviously, well, I'll just end it there. What's it like?
For me, it's been invaluable. Like I said, it was one, not an area I wanted to spend time educating myself in. Two, I think, like I said, there's not enough education, especially for women. There's a little bit of intimidation of doing it the right way, stocks, bonds, all the aspects of investing. And so it just felt like the right decision for me. 3 or 4 years ago, I started learning about, okay, AUM. Fee structure is not necessarily ideal as your portfolio grows. Mine wasn't particularly complex. My situation wasn't particularly complex. So I started poking around and learning about what management fees or other sort of arrangements. And I came across Eddie and Travis at Downshift, I think through a different network, but I interviewed a number of flat fee advisors and I really like them. They're just so wonderful and easy to talk to. And at the time, you know, there's certain filters that you use to select an advisor. For me, it was just the feeling I got. Once you have the basics, like, do they know what they're talking about? Are they legit? Look at their reviews. Then you just have a feeling. And I really liked my interview with them. And so I've been with them for about a year and I couldn't be happier. And I do think for me, being with a flat fee advisor, this level of my portfolio is the right thing to do. I'm so angry at my boyfriend who's been with Edward Jones and pays his stupid 1% fee. And it's just one of those guys who's like path of least resistance. There's no problems. Let's just keep it. So my push is to get him to switch over to Downshift as well. But I'm really happy with my new advisors.
Got it. Okay, perfect. Yeah. And like, I mean, I'm a path of least resistance person too, but like, there's a price to it. And like, once you look at the actual numbers and the opportunity cost, then I'm like, oh shit, like that's a lot. Like, no, yeah. So it's up to anyone to make the decision. And just because it's not optimal doesn't mean it's like not right. We're not telling people what to do, but I understand your frustration.
Yes.
Okay. So, and we'll link up, like I said, Travis and Eddie, they're friends of mine and they've been on the show a couple times, I think. So we'll link up if people want to check it out. All right. Back to the story. So you started investing relatively early, working your career, and somehow I've ended up making several friends that are like early retiree lawyers. Turns out a lot of lawyers don't like being lawyers, so they quit. Can you talk a little bit about your career trajectory? Because it sounds like you're an overachiever. You did very well, like whatever things you're setting your goals to, like you're doing a really good job. So how did that look in your career?
Yeah, I mean, I was definitely one of the unhappy lawyers. I was miserable as a lawyer. I was in big law in New York City. It was pretty grotto as an environment, but I was afraid of leaving. It was my identity. I felt my family would be disappointed. So it took a few years. And back in the day, again, I'm 47. Back in the day, 20 years ago, it wasn't common to leave as common as it is now. Like, there was a lot more of a stigma. And there were not as many options outside of law. So we kind of felt like, I'm going to throw away all my education to do what? So it was a challenging decision, but I did leave. And it's a very long story, which I'm not going to go into, but I ended up doing, I was the head of leadership training and development for a law firm. So I ended up going in-house and training leaders, which is when I got my master's in leadership development, which is a great transition. And I liked it, but I was eventually decided I was still in law working with lawyers who were miserable. So I wanted out, which is kind of like when I left and traveled for a year and completely left the legal industry. But I did a slower transition. I didn't leave the law industry. I left the practice and I left the legal industry altogether.
Okay. And it sounds like it worked well for you. Is that, would you recommend people to make a more gradual transition instead of just ending like their career and the identity with the career? Like, did that work well for you, I guess?
It worked really well for me. I coach a lot of folks who want to leave the legal profession. I don't think there's one right way. Everyone has a different family situation, financial need situation. Some people are so burnt out and so unhealthily miserable that they must probably make a clean break. And there's so many other things they can do, but there's so many components that go into that decision. I really recommend just taking some time to think about the next move, whatever that's going to look like, what they need. For me, the transition was helpful mostly from a mindset perspective and identity perspective. I could still claim to be in the legal profession. And that was, you know, somewhat healing because I had a lot of shame with my decision. Now, obviously, all of that's gone, but it wasn't easy at the time. So I think it's an individual decision. I actually made carefully, but there's so many ways to do it. And if you feel stuck and think there's nothing else you can do, just look at all the role models ahead of you that have done so many different things and are happier and making quite a bit of money and having the prestige that you think is only available with law.
So you stopped the law career overall at age 40. And it took you a little while to lead up to it. You know, part was like just the identity. Some was thinking about your family and how they may react to it. So I'm going to ask a few things around that. When did you like discover early retirement? Did you also read like Mr. Money Mustache and other blogs, 1500 days, stuff like that in those years when you were thinking, hey, I'm going to stop working early?
I did not. I'd never come across Mr. Money Mustache until I was already retired. I had been hearing about the 4% rule and that if you had 25 times your expenses, you could retire. And I was at that number at 40. So I was just starting conversation with my financial advisor to try to understand, is this realistic? What does that mean? And I had always wanted flexibility. For many reasons, being European, I didn't understand the concept of 4 weeks of vacation. Like, I just wanted the ability to be able to go home and see my family and travel for longer. And I always dreamt of, okay, if I was going to work, I was going to work for 6 months and then 6 months off, I will travel. And so that was sort of the impetus of me seeking something different than what I'd seen done. And when I came across the 4% rule and I started looking at my numbers, I had completely non-intentionally arrived at a really good place. And so I took some time off. I'd taken two sabbaticals, one when I had quit law and then one of when I had left New York and quit the legal industry. And so I traveled for about a year. And so I knew I had time to take a few more years and figure out what to do. And that's kind of how I've done iterations of different things. And that's how I've arrived to what I'm doing now, which is completely optionally working for fun because I love coaching. Yeah, I'll just stop here.
Okay. And then what about your family? Like you said, a long string of professionals. So how did your family react in the early days? And I hope now they're like, oh, you're traveling, you're doing stuff you're passionate about. You're obviously happier than you were when you were working a job that you didn't want to. So how did they react initially when you started bringing up the fact that you were going to stop being a lawyer?
Just shockingly enough, they just wanted me to be happy. I mean, if they had any reservations, they were not open about them. I guess they've always trusted that I'm super self-reliant and I make smart decisions. And it's funny, my dad always turns anything I tell him into like, this is the smartest thing that anyone's ever done. Like he just has such belief in me. And so every time I've done things, he's like, yep, that's how she's doing great. And so I've come to realize that ultimately you have one life and you have to live it for you. And the people who love you may not see the same way you do, but they will support you. And that's what I've had with my family, even, and especially after cancer. They just want me to live my life to the fullest. There isn't really any judgment. I retired before my mom did, which is crazy. But then I've supported my mom all of my life. So it's not, there's no guilt there, but it's an interesting situation to find yourself in.
Otherwise, you know, any friends or other people that were like, what are you doing? Obviously you have peers at work that have, you know, maybe you know them for a decade or something like that. And they're like, what are you doing? You're like, you've built this foundation and you're just walking away from it. So how did that go?
I have found that some of those sentiments come from their own fear that they can do it or desire for the same, but because they can take the step, they want to judge you as being sort of risky. There's definitely judgment. People probably talk behind my back and maybe make assumptions, but it hasn't outwardly impacted my relationships. And I think it's becoming more common and more understood. So there's less stigma. I've not had any significant consequences. If it's happening, it's happening without my knowledge and probably is happening. But I try not to let other people's opinions of how I should live my life impact me.
What about the inverse? Did someone say, that's very interesting. How did you do this? And can you tell me about it? And then you impacted their life where they've now exited early.
Yeah, for sure. There have been people who have wanted my advice and people have taken sabbaticals because I've made it okay for them to consider it and given them a roadmap to, there's what you can do. This is how it can look like. This is what it looks like for me. I definitely have inspired younger women to consider different paths, which is wonderful. And it certainly raises a question when people first find out. They're like, oh, we're super young. What did you do? And how did you do it? I find that some people just say that they really don't want to know, and others are genuinely interested because they're thinking of that for themselves. So yeah, it's happened. It's nice.
That's pretty cool. So when you stopped working, you traveled for about a year. Were you thinking, I'm not going back to work? This math works out and my advisor is telling me everything's cool? Or were you like, this is a sabbatical, I'm going to travel, I'm going to decompress, and then we'll see what happens later?
So my last travel sabbatical happened when I was 39. So right before I realized I don't have to work, it was very much a desire to take break and have a blank slate, because I was like, I can't take a job after this because the salary expectation will be so high that I'd limit myself. So I traveled for a year and I came back, you know, I hadn't worked. So starting from zero, I gave myself options to consider pretty much anything. And then the following year, I got to, okay, I don't really have to do this.
Okay. Some of us, I've gotten over this, but some of us have like a drive to be productive all the time. And part of it's like in our head where we're thinking, oh, if I have time, I should be doing something productive. And I think part of it is like outside, like what people think of us. And if I'm not doing something productive, people will think I'm lazy, which I've now embraced so much. I don't even care. But do you have that thing where you're like, I need to be doing something all the time? And then how does that come into play with, you know, taking a sabbatical and taking breaks and just, you know, not working a full-time job?
That is such a good question. I think it's at the crux of what retirement means to me and sort of the only challenge that I've had. I am 150% someone who wants to be productive and equates that with success and meaning in my life. And partially because, I guess, in law, you bill by the hour. And so you have this expectation, like everything has to be productive. And that has been my biggest work, is to just allow myself to be in rest, to be in joy, to be in pleasure. And it doesn't come easily because by nature, I'm a very active person who is high energy, but I'm learning to allow the productive things to be workouts and walks and reading. And we talked a little bit in the pre-recording about ultra marathons or training for big fitness challenges. That to me is, gives you purpose, gives you a reason to get up, gives you a sense of progress, and it's productive and it's healthy. So those are the kind of things that I want to occupy my time with. Obviously travel and spending time with friends and doing other enjoyable things that don't necessarily have to have an outcome that someone can reflect upon. That's been my challenge, but I'm working on it.
Do you have any like current, you know, challenges with it? You've been retired or at least working on your own terms for several years. So is there anything where you're like, you know what, I need to read more. I want to read more and just sit down and read for whatever, 90 minutes a day or something like that. So anything you're currently like working on to be like less productive / the things that you find valuable?
I mean, it's a slow transition. I think I have been able to allow podcasts. They're usually around topics that are improving me in some way, but I still find that super enjoyable. So that's been a big chunk of my time. I also, for the first time in 45 years, have decided to read fiction. When I travel, surprisingly, I have none of those negative thoughts. I just feel like this is pure joy and it's novel and adventurous. And I feel really, productive is not the right word, but just fulfilled. At home, I always get a workout in, I get a podcast or a book in, I make healthy meals, I can talk to friends on the phone, I love dancing, so I try to do that. It's still a challenge. There are days when I'm ashamed to be more productive when I have to rein it in.
When you stop working, you don't have the structure. And, you know, you came from a very structured industry. So how do you like plan your weeks or your days? Because, you know, there's some days where you're like, I'm going to do this one big, maybe you're going for a hike. You're like, I'm hiking for 4 hours. So you're not going to do probably too much else that day. But yeah, how do you structure your week so you're getting like the different pieces that fulfill you, whether it's, you know, an intellectual challenge or something social or something physical? How do you plan that out from days to weeks to months?
Yeah, I usually plan a week ahead, and there's usually a couple of key things that have a time-specific component that go in the calendar. So if it's a client call or a workout class, that it's at a given time, or lunch with a friend. And so then I build blocks of, okay, what do I want to get done that will go in the calendar, but it can be flexible. I can move it up or down depending on what I feel like doing. So there's spontaneity and flexibility with a couple of key components that keep me structured. And so I have like, okay, if I have a workout at 10 and then an open time, I can do the five things that I want for that day in any order that I want to. Other days are more structured, but I find it's a good mix of having routine or structure, having a lot of free time.
I do a very similar thing. So it's good that you mentioned like open space where it's kind of like free time or whatever. So you just have like a couple things, a couple like signposts along your day. And then the rest, you can do it. You can move stuff around. One of the big things, I mean, you and I are not too busy, but some people, they have like way more stuff going on and there's always something that like goes wrong or takes longer. And if you don't have any slack, then your whole day gets goofed up. And for some people, myself included, once something goes off track, I feel like I'm late for everything, even if it's like an arbitrary plan. So like open space is really good because something is going to go wrong or different or traffic is longer or something like that. So it sounds like open space is a piece that you actually factor in and you're like, I want to have time.
Yeah. I mean, I was that person, but I had zero white space between meetings and it just feels so, I just feel like the luckiest and richest person in the world having that freedom. Freedom to me and independence is one of my biggest values and I cherish it every day. It makes me so happy.
So we didn't talk much in the pre-interview, but we mentioned cancer. So what can you share? What would you like to share with your diagnosis, the battle with cancer, and anything you want to share?
Yeah, I'm happy to share anything that's of interest that kind of give you the major highlights and then you can ask questions. But I got diagnosed at 45 and it was a complete shock one because I was always very healthy. At least I thought I was happy. I was fit. I ate well. I exercised. There's no history in my family. I felt great. And it was a lump that I felt myself. And I was told, several exams that I was fine. There was nothing to worry about. And I kept persisting. And I finally had a mammogram that revealed it was cancer. Had a mammogram that showed something. And then I had a biopsy that confirmed cancer. So certainly devastating and surprising and shows that you have to advocate for yourself. I ended up getting a second opinion. And after my mastectomy, they found a lot more tumors that were missed in the first surgery and just a lot of complications along the way. I'm healthy now. I feel great. I'm strong. I regained all my strength. I mean, I credit a lot of my pre-strength to being able to recover quickly and get back into a normal life and my discipline with really cleaning out my life. I thought I was healthy, but I doubled down on things like water filters and air filters and eating more protein and certain things that I hadn't been particularly conscious about. So not a lot of takeaways other than I feel incredibly fortunate to have been financially independent, to quit working, to take care of myself. I already was living a life that was very fulfilling and in line with my values. And so I continued to do that.
Thanks for sharing that. It's like how long from like the diagnosis to when you recovered and you were like, I'm feeling like myself again?
That is a nuanced question. In terms of medical intervention, it was about a year and a half because I didn't do chemotherapy, but I had some failed or unsuccessful surgeries. The mental component is what people usually don't talk about. And I don't know that there's ever a place where you get to where you don't think about cancer coming back or you get back to normal. The new normal is not the old normal. There are things that I have to live with that, you know, will never be the same. But I was very lucky that I had time to dig into, okay, what is emotional healing? What is mental healing? What do I need? The components that are not typically supported by our medical system. So I feel very fortunate. I'm in a really great place, but I don't think it will ever be the same.
Do you have any advice for someone who's going through cancer or their family is, just anything sort of broadly that you could share?
So much. And I think, honestly, if someone listens to this podcast and wants to reach out to me, I'm happy. I think the journey is so individual. Cancer is such an individual disease. Like you may have breast cancer and have completely different disease and experience than someone else with the same breast cancer. I think that you will have a lot of guilt towards your caregivers because you're not going to be able to repay them or you don't feel like you can be grateful enough, and all they're going to want to do is just give. And so you have to accept that help. And you're going to lose a lot of friends who are not going to want to be there for you, but a lot of beautiful things will also emerge. And I think the one thing that stands out for me is like, I was in a really dark place. I've had such a good life. with lots of difficulties, but a really good life. And I was in a place where I just didn't see any lights. I was like, this is not a place I want to live in. And after everything dark, something wonderful comes out. And you just have to remember that when it's super, super hard, like just know that something better will come around the corner. And I wish I had believed that, because in the moment, people are like, it's going to be fine. And you just want to punch them in the face. And it doesn't feel believable, but it did for me. It's been a really great next chapter.
Let's shift gears. And you are doing coaching. You're self-employed, so it's all on your own terms, right? And you're doing, you said self-discipline coaching. Can you tell us what does that mean?
Yes. Well, so I believe that self-discipline is the foundation for anything you want to accomplish in life. It's such an amazing skill that gives you freedom, gives you self-respect, gives you agency, and it allows you to be consistent, to do the things that you don't feel like doing or you don't want to do, but are necessary to accomplish your goals. And so I started out as a leadership coach for startup leaders. And I found that while there's a lot of aspects very specific to leadership, there's a component around self-discipline that was incredibly important for everyone. And since then, I've obviously opened up to working with anyone on self-discipline, because I believe it's such a wonderful, necessary skill to have. And so it can help with certainly losing weight, being fit, being rich, not procrastinating, accomplishing what you want, having better relationships. It's such a, to me, a superpower. So that's what I do now. And self-discipline has come easy to me, but I've spent a lot of time studying it and understanding it and understanding habit creation and understanding the science behind it. So I just love it. I love working with people and helping them have that impact.
How many hours a week do you work?
So it totally varies on what travels I've planned or how many clients I'll take. I have an online course, which is great because that's very helpful and I don't have to do anything. But the one-on-one clients, it depends on what I have going on. Currently, I have 4 clients and I love it because it allows me to still do my travels. I usually take more clients in the beginning of the year.
Okay. And that fits when people are like, I'm going to make a change or whatever, right?
Yes, exactly. Okay.
So it's a little bit of time, but not too much. And then the online course, how are you getting like new leads in to, you know, check out that course, or how do you find your clients to work with?
Yeah, I thankfully don't do a lot because I don't want a lot of traffic, but a lot of word of mouth. So all of my lawyer clients, legal community, they refer me. And then I have an online presence on Instagram and LinkedIn that feeds a lot of new clients. And so sometimes I'll have a wait list, sometimes I don't. The online course is very inexpensive. So people who find me just want to check it out is their first sort of intro to my work. I've done group coaching as well. I currently don't offer that, but there's just different variations of what I do depending on my time plans and time for the year.
Gotcha. So what kind of, you kind of mention some of the things that people could work with you on, but like, can you make up an example for us? Obviously, you're working with clients, so you don't want to compromise any information, but like, yeah, what kind of stuff might someone come to you? They're like, I want to make a change.
I literally have had the most diverse set of clients, but weight loss is very common. People, a lot of scientists want to publish a book, PhDs want to finish their dissertation. People who want to start a business, people who want to scale a business, people who want to train for a fitness competition. That's very common. Anything that requires something that you don't want to do consistently and you need help with falls under the, you know, umbrella. But it's been interesting. I never know what someone's going to want discipline with, and it's just such a fun challenge.
Oh, I'm thinking of writing this book on laziness, but still studying the nuances of not doing the work. So
that's funny. Well, listen, I can give you lots of examples.
All right. So we got to start wrapping up, but I know there's a couple interesting pieces along the way of like expenses. And the thing is, like, whenever we're planning for early retirement, we're looking at a point in time, but we know whatever our assumptions are around expenses, those are going to change. There's inflation. Maybe we move. there's some other life change. So you've had a few years under your belt. Can you talk about how your expenses have changed over time? And we'll hopefully be able to get into some of the details of your expenses as well. But let's look at the change. So assumptions early on, you moved from New York to Texas and that sort of thing. So how have your expenses changed?
You know what? I think this will be true for a lot of folks in this community. We're more frugal than we're spenders. And so even if I have a budget, and let's just say I'll use $100,000, this is just an easy, clean number. I can spend it easily, but I find myself slightly under, only because whatever budget I have, in my mind, I just don't want to touch it. So my muscle challenge is get the muscle of spending. And expenses haven't changed that much in terms of the core expenses, because I bought my house in Texas as soon as I moved here. So that's been consistent, slightly up or down, depending on like assessments and how often I go out. But travel is my biggest bucket. And that's kind of where I can always spend more. So I have to decide like what makes me happy. And you and I briefly talked about this. My desired at this level expenditure for travel is $45,000 per year. And that's easy. I can get there. But I have to, for everything else, I find myself like I'm usually under, because I always play this game with myself. Like maybe I'll be under this month and then I can do it like add it to the next month, and I never do. So I feel like most of us will have this problem. If you get too high, you probably won't have trouble fitting within your budget.
Right. And then did your, so $45,000 for a travel budget is, that's pretty good. You could probably do some cool stuff. Did that expand over time, or has that been like one of the huge buckets that you've had allotted?
That's always been the biggest bucket for me. What's expanded, it has expanded, and I guess I fly business class more often now, and I travel a lot more often. So before I would do 3 big trips that were all expensive. Now I'll do 10. I'm gone almost twice a month, but this past year I was gone almost twice a month, and they weren't as expensive, but the buckets stayed the same. So I like the flexibility of playing then that number each year, depending on what I want to do. Like, is it one big blowout trip, like the one you and I talked about, that cruise to Antarctica, or is it 20 little, you know, weekend getaways?
One thing we realized, because we've done some slow travel, which suits us pretty well most of the time. We often travel with our dog, and being away from home is not ideal. And we realize that we miss stuff from home, which is a good thing. Like, we're like, oh, we like the routine. We have a community here. Our house is comfortable. We sleep better in our own bed, that sort of thing. So we're like, oh, maybe I don't want to be away as often as I was like the previous year. So it's, you know, it shifts, but we're observing what we want. And we're like, we want to be home a little bit more. So how much do you like to be on the road? Can you talk about that sort of thing?
Yeah, that's such a common experience. I think even for people who have high desire for novelty, which I definitely think I fall under, having a boyfriend who works full time, which means I do a lot of my travel solo, is the reason why I'm like, okay, I'm excited to come back. I'm excited to see him. Housewise, we're currently in transition, so we're trying to move out to the mountains. So I don't miss coming to this house, because in my mind, it's temporary, but I do like having the routine of cooking my healthy meals, going to the gym, having that part under my control. And I enjoy that. I probably still want to come home and sleep in my bed and have that sort of community and the things that I know, but way less than I do now. Now I try to be home for 2 weeks every month to be with him.
Okay. And then you briefly mentioned one of the aspects that we realized too, is just like the workout routine or the gym that you go to, and fitness is an important part of your life. So how do you work out on the road / stay in shape when you are gone, potentially, you know, 50% of the time?
Yeah. I mean, I find that I'm just so much more active. I would be walking 30,000 steps when I was just in South Korea earlier this year. And there's one day when I walked 45,000 steps and I didn't even know it. It was just so fun because I wanted to see all these things and I didn't want to be on subways. And potentially, you eat cleaner food, because outside of the US, things are less processed. So I always find myself being, without trying, staying healthy. I certainly don't lift weights, which is a big part of my regimen, and I miss that. I actually find myself not wanting to go to gyms when I travel. It feels very, I don't know, anticlimactic. Like, why did I come to this gorgeous place to be in an indoor, unless the gym is on the beach or something. But I find that's never an issue. I do a lot of hikes. So unless if I'm in a city, I'll be walking. If I'm in nature doing something, that goes without saying, it's never been an issue.
And that makes sense with the steps, but just for people that don't know, like 45,000 steps, that's like 24 miles or something like that. Do you know how many miles that was that day?
20-ish. It was like a marathon, slightly less than it was the most I've done. Typically over 30,000 would be on most days.
Okay. That's a lot of steps.
I have short legs, so maybe it's not that many miles, you know?
I was trying to do the math. Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Very cool. All right. So the other part that I want to get to, actually, before we move on, anything else around expenses or anything that you've learned along the way? Like, how are you? Do you need a self-disciplined coach to get you to spend some more money? It sounds like you're in this habit loop of not reaching your budget.
Yeah. I think partially why I'm not yet spending fully is because of this transition where we're about to buy a new house. My boyfriend's working. There's just a lot of things that are shifting. And yeah, maybe I will need to work on my own muscle of spending. I have been thinking a lot about the safe withdrawal rate and how most advisors, as lovely as they are, will probably try to be a little bit more conservative because they want your portfolio to last. But I just feel like because we're all very smart people and have lots of room to be flexible, like there'll never be a point where if you start withdrawing 5% and things are not going well, there's never going to be a point where things are out of control. You have time to adjust and be flexible. And I think the fear is underspending way more than it's running out of money. And so that's kind of what I want to optimize for. Certainly, Die With Zero has informed a lot of my sort of approach to spending, but it's finding the right withdrawal, right? Finding the right amount where you can enjoy life. I don't have kids, so I don't necessarily need to have a lot to leave behind, but playing around with all the uncertainty that's ahead of us and finding the right number.
For several years, although you're making some income. So have you had to draw down? Have you had to sell some of your initial nest egg, which that's a fear for some people if they haven't had to flex that muscle and actually like sell some of their shares that they've been accumulating for like 25 years?
Yeah, I hear a lot about that. I haven't yet had to. And I think one of the advantages of working with a financial advisor for me is that I won't be doing it. It will be a number that I get each year that will be given to me. And so however they do it, I don't have to know. But I do hear a lot of folks having that problem for sure.
Okay. And actually, that's one reason that like it could be valuable to have an advisor. So I actually like, we manage our own money. So like our advisor would be like, sell this or do this kind of thing. And then we execute it. But there's, our brain still works. And we're like, well, the market's down. What if I wait until tomorrow? And then you could play that out over the course of whatever, 6 months or whatever, and you're in your head. So you've actually like delegated that to the team and they do it. And then they'll tell you about it later, right?
They may not even tell me.
They don't need to.
Yeah. Meaning like if I say I want to have $100,000 this year, I don't care how they get to it. Obviously, ideally, least tax consequence and all of the things that they have taken into account. I don't need to know what positions are being sold or moved.
Great. And yeah, and then you're totally insulated and they're doing their job. And that's not for everybody. Some people want in the details, but like that's what you want. All right. So as we're wrapping up here, and you've mentioned, you know, your boyfriend's still working and it's challenging because we have our own opinions. You've been thinking about like not working and retiring and all this stuff for a long time, but like for some people it's newer and it takes some time for them to come around to the idea, and we all have different approaches. So can you talk about how you're dealing with this somewhat volatile situation where it's like, you want this, you want to travel. How does that work out?
Yeah, it definitely has taken some adjustments, compromise. The relationship is still healthy that I'm telling myself, okay, if this is the only major sort of disagreement, it's not a big deal, especially since I've tried to decide, okay, what's important to me? Travel, adventure, novelty, and I get to do that. I wish he were with me, but he isn't, and he doesn't mind me doing it. Not that he's not mind. He doesn't, I don't care if he minds. It's not an issue. And so it's wonderful that I still get to do what I want. And hopefully a few years down the line, we'll be together. But it hasn't become a big problem. It's more of a, it would be nice to have, but it's certainly not a deal breaker. I get agitated in my head because I think I know better and I should tell how to live his life. And he's kind enough to let me vent and like, sure, kind of pat on the back, nothing changes. And so come to realize it's too premature. He's not comfortable where he's at to retire, and I get it. And he's not comfortable leaning on my portfolio because we're not married. And I get that. And it's work in progress.
And people that listen to the show often, like Elizabeth, she retired like 18 months ago, but I thought we were ready a couple years before that. So I was like probably a little too aggressive at times, and we argued a lot about money. And eventually I realized it's not a, you know, it's not a spreadsheet issue. She, like, we know the numbers, it's like other stuff. And I, you know, I backed off and we got to a place where she was comfortable with the numbers and everything, or more comfortable with it. And it worked out fine. She really enjoys not working. But yeah, it was a struggle. It was like our biggest disagreement. And I mean, it's a good problem to have. Like we were not talking about like, we don't have enough money to pay our bills. It was like nuance of like how much we have versus how much we might spend in a super long, you know, time horizon of, you know, 50 years, we maybe have to think about the portfolio lasting. So it's tough. You guys will figure it out.
Yeah. And that gives me hope that to know that when you push too far, it's probably going to back away, sorry, to not work. And then when you let the person come along on their own, it probably helps.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tough. And everyone's different. So
yeah, fair.
All right. Well, that wraps up the stuff that I wanted to cover. Is there anything else on your mind that I forgot to ask you about that you want to share?
Well, I think this is great.
All right. Well, where can people find you if you want them to? Obviously, you have some coaching going on and all that, but you don't want to have too many clients come in. So whatever mm-hmm. you want to share is cool. And we could put a link in the description so people can find it if you want them to find it.
Yeah, no, I'd love for people to find me on Instagram. I post daily with lots of super easy self-discipline hacks, and I don't advertise. So it's very purely educational. So it's a self-discipline coach. I think there's an underscore there, but so self-discipline coach should come up. And then on LinkedIn, it's Monica Levy Coaching. I am somewhat active there, but those are my two main social media avenues, and that's it.
Perfect. All right. It was great catching up, and enjoy your upcoming travels.
Okay. Great to see you.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. All right. In the pre-interview stuff that we were chatting, you mentioned that you're interested in doing like ultra marathons and like endurance sports and stuff like that. So is there something on your radar? Are you currently like a long distance runner or athlete or anything like that?
I consider myself a lifelong athlete, not in any sort of traditional way, but I've always worked out in any capacity I can. It's a joy of mine. And I, now that I'm retired, I'm always thinking of how can I have a purposeful endeavor each year that's not related to work, but that gives me sort of a sense of progress. And obviously the thing that comes to mind is some sort of fitness challenge. So I'm not a huge runner. I used to be a marathon runner. I prefer things that are more high intensity sort of, you know, training. So it may not be an ultra marathon per se, but it has to be something that requires training and progress that I can measure and that's ultimately accomplished. So I'm super attracted to that idea.
Gotcha. Yeah. It's been a while. I usually make sure I preface it. I'm like, oh, it's been, you know, at this point, the last half marathon was like in 2017. So it's like, it's been a while, but for a stretch, like I was running and I liked, you know, around an hour plus to run, but I never ran anything further. However, I still have an interest in like ultra marathons, even if it's just like as a, you know, me watching people train or whatever. It's kind of fun. I love the idea, but it takes so much time. Like even if I have a lot of free time, I'm like, okay, if you're going for like a long run and I hear people like, oh, I'm going for a 20 miler in the mountains. I mean, that's going to take them like 8 hours or something like
that. Really?
So have you done any like trail running or, and you mentioned like it doesn't necessarily have to be like an ultra marathon, but other high endurance and long-term goals. So what stuff have you done like outside of just, it sounds like straight like road running marathons that you did?
Yeah, I haven't done running challenges, but I've hiked the Himalayas and I've done Machu Picchu. Like I've done long treks, like over 10 days where you're consistently climbing. And I find that to be really fun because it's a lot more social. So it's still pretty intense as ever. And Kilimanjaro is potentially on my list, except for the cold. I really don't like being that cold. But I like that kind of sort of physical challenge that has definitive periods. And so if there's a social component, it's super fun for me.
Gotcha. Interesting. So do you have one on your list? Or like, what do you think the first thing you're going to do is?
I don't. Yeah, that's a good question. So I've been sort of poking around and seeing what other people are doing and waiting for the, it sounds funny, like for the thing that gets me, but I don't think it's going to be that. It's, I'm going to have to pick something, go for it. And then kind of, because I think there's so much out there. Like I am an optimizer and I tend to get overwhelmed by, oh my God, not to optimize the thing I trained for rather than just pick any one thing that sounds fun. Yeah. So I have to watch myself for that.
Gotcha. Yeah. And I've noticed one thing, well, I'm again, remembering many years ago, but when I did have like a big goal, it helped influence other more unhealthy things that I was doing. So like if I was going for a long run that week, which typically would be like some long run, I would like watch what I was eating or be a lot more conscious like the 2 days beforehand, because I knew I was going to, you know, beat up my body and I needed to have the right fuel in me. So I missed that a lot. And I'm like, oh, I should, you know, here in Colorado, occasionally I'll do 14ers in the mountains, but I haven't been doing that. I haven't been setting like the goal. So it is really good for me for the long term, again, just like influence and how it impacts like my day-to-day decisions. And it sounds like you were nodding. So you do the same kind of thing, right?
I just love that reflection, because as a discipline coach, I teach that so much, like your influence. It's so much easier to be disciplined when the environment supports it. So if you create a goal like that, or if your partner is working towards something like that, you're just more easily influenced instead of having to use willpower for that. And so it's almost like you're setting yourself up for success is the unintended benefit.
Yes. And I've been doing like the opposite, which earlier this year I was like doing a beer judging competition and I was like, I want to do a good job. So I needed to like practice beer. So yeah, I'm like literally doing the opposite where I'm like setting up poor habits to do more poor decisions. And then that's one of those where like if you drink, if you start judging beer at like 8 a.m, usually it doesn't lead to like better decisions like later in the day if you're like having a beer at lunch and stuff like that. Yeah. I mean, you're not, when you judge beer, it's not a huge amount, but you are starting early. Yeah. And then, you know, by lunch, I will have had maybe 2 or 3 beers worth, which typically on a normal day, I don't do that.
Yeah. Well, maybe you can alternate the years. 1 year of like more fun challenges and 1 year of like super tough fitness.
Healthy. I am due for a healthy one. Yeah.
Perfect.